House Water Committee, this is 15th of April, 2003, and we are in work session only today. And to start with, the chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and reconsideration of House Bill 2459 be taken immediately. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The chair requests unanimous consent that the motion on House Bill 2459 do pass be reconsidered. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The staff will provide an explanation regarding the reconsideration to include the proposed amendment and whatever the new motion is required.
House Bill 2459 requires hatchery fish bred from wild stocks to be considered wild fish and allows to spawn. Requires hatchery propagation to be from wild fish. This bill is reconsidered for two reasons. There's a potential amendment, and second, it would have to be referred to Ways and Means because there was a large fiscal on it. Therefore, we've brought it back. The amendment in question is the dash ones, and the members should have that in their files. Basically, eliminates the last part of line 13 and line and all of line 14. Which is basically requires hatchery propagation from just wild fish.
Okay.
That's it.
We are temporarily going to close the work session on House Bill 2459, then, and open a work session on House Bill 2255.
House Bill 2255 allows Department of Human Services to assess per-connection fees on water suppliers to administer Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. Last meeting, there was a dash one amendments offered. Then there was a decision to make a slight change to those. You have the dash twos now in front of you. Basically, the change to the dash twos was adding on line five of those amendments up to 12 members to the committee and adding a potential of up to 3 members representing other public water systems. We all agreed to that, but we could not do a consensual, or at least the committee had no objections, and we wanted to do a consensual, but then decided to go through the full process. So therefore, 2255 amendments we'd be considering as potentially 2255-2. These amendments will also likely remove the need for a referral to Ways and Means, so the committee might want to consider asking for to rescind the Ways and Means referral, or it could go to Ways and Means and be referred out of that committee. That's up to the committee members.
Is that a recess or at ease for just a minute? At this point, the chair would accept a motion to move the dash twos to House Bill 2275.
So moved.
55.
Representative Tomei moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2255. Is there any objection? So ordered. The chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2255 to the floor with the due pass recommendation with the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is still referred to Ways and Means?
Yes, there is. The amendments may change it, but.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2255 to the floor with subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion on the motion. With a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, any questions? You will recall that there was some considerable controversy on this between the League of Oregon Cities and the Human Services Department having to do with clean drinking water issues. the amendment addresses then a study of that and a work group to act during the interim for the purposes of coming up with a solution to this so that both sides' issues are being addressed and are being met. The chair is in support of this, but we'd like to move it on. Would you call a roll, please?
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Schaubler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Aye.
Representative Krupp.
Excused.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. House Bill 2255 will be moved to the Committee on Ways and Means for their consideration. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2255. Open a work session on 2515. We'll close that work session and open a work session on House Bill 3620.
Get ahead of me. House Bill 3620 removes sediment from definition of ballast water, allows vessel to discharge treated ballast water in manner approved by Department of Environmental Quality and compatible with regional and federal requirements, requires owner or operator of the vessel to report ballast water management within 24 hours after vessel enters Oregon port, creates task force on ballast water management, requires task force to report to the Legislative Assembly before October 1st, 2004, declares emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments as of yet. There is a prior referral to Ways and Means.
I understand. Members, this particular bill is an important bill that we have before us. The bill, however, has a significant fiscal. We're trying to work this out. I've asked, however, first here to have the Port of Portland come up and give us, if you wish, an explanation of this, and then we can deal with the issue of how to deal with the significant fiscal and see if there's a way around that. So that's Keith Levitt to present a little bit about this bill to us and its need and why we're doing it, and where the problem is as far as the significant fiscal, so that we can address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Keith Levitt with the Port of Portland, and there are two other individuals that when they come into the room, they can join me. One of those individuals is Dr. Mark Sisma from Portland State University, who has been in the forefront of dealing with invasive species issues in Oregon for the last several years. The context for this bill began last session. Some of you who were here will recall that we passed the first ballast water bill in Oregon last session. And what we were able to create in law last session was the ability to better manage or invasive species that can come in the ballast of large ships that call at ports in Oregon. We have on the Columbia River some 2,000 ship calls a year, and there's a higher risk for having invasive species come in from foreign ports if you don't have a good ballast water management strategy. And so that's what we passed last session. What this bill is before you this session is frankly just technical amendments to what was passed last time. This is an evolving issue. The states of Washington and California have ballast water laws. All three states on the West Coast passed their laws literally within the last year and a half, 2 years. The federal government, unfortunately, is not moving as fast as we need them to, but there is movement at the federal level to have a more uniform approach to this, and frankly, that's what is needed. We're dealing with international commerce. We're dealing with organisms coming in from foreign ports. And so we do need a more stable approach from the federal level. In the absence of that, we are working with the states of California and Washington through a ballast water task force that was created as a result of the legislation last session. And the bill before you came out of that task force work. That was a group that was made up of folks from the steamship industry, from the ports, from the environmental community, and there was a couple of legislative members as ad hoc members of that committee as well. And so this bill makes some changes to the law that was passed last time, none of which are of any real substantive nature to the policies, all of which are needed to allow Oregon to evolve in its approach to ballast water as this changing landscape continues to evolve. The fiscal impact issue, Mr. Chair.
I just wanted to say that don't add to your testimony just for the purpose of trying to kill time.
You don't want me to just fill time?
I don't want you to fill time.
Thinking about a joke or two.
Well, we might entertain those. I mean, you know, we're hard pressed sometimes in this business to not take ourselves too seriously. So, we can come back in a minute if the other people aren't here. What's the issue with the fiscal? If you could help.
Yeah, the issue with the fiscal is simply that there is a part of the bill that would have DEQ creating standards and guidelines that would create a fiscal on them. We weren't aware of that until yesterday, and I think we can amend the bill to release them of that responsibility. That's what we're working on right now, and within a few minutes we should be able to report out to you on what those amendments would look like.
Keith, how are we going to have these standards, and if DEQ doesn't do them, help me with that, or is this just kind of play it loosely sort of game?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, and that frankly is the challenge with Oregon's ballast water law. We have not had resources. The same issue happened to us last session, where we had to reduce the fiscal impact that DEQ would have, and then since then all the budget cuts occurred. And until we are in line to get federal grants to help run this program, and through Dr. Sisma, we have done that, and he was able to staff the task force through federal funds and through other funds. So it creates a mechanism in which the federal government can send grant money to, but until the agency, till DEQ, has the resources to do the compliance piece as effectively as possible, then we'll always have a good program that keeps track of what's happening with ballast water, but frankly it falls a little bit short as far as the compliance piece.
The chair is aware of the significance of this ballast water bill, having heard that story now for quite some time in the legislature, and recognizing that, of course, if we do nothing, it has the potential to possibly solve our salmon problem by making the runs of salmon in the Columbia River extinct. And therefore we wouldn't have to deal with all of those issues as far as salmon are concerned if we I guess the chair's point with this, it's a major major issue, a major concern as far as the state is concerned. So
Mr. Chair,
I'm interested. Yes, I know
Dr. Sisma is here now, so if you wanted to continue, we can do that.
Thank you. If you would, Doctor, we're on tight time schedules today, so.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just a question, maybe the doctor could address this. And I mean, you know, we're amending to take DEQ out of this, but wouldn't it make sense if we have a three-state group doing this, that whatever standards are adopted would be uniform in Oregon, Washington, California? So maybe it's premature to have DEQ setting standards until they've been approved on a larger scale anyway. I mean, you know.
For the record, my name is Mark Sitzma with Portland State University. Mr. Chair, Representative, I think you're exactly right. We've been working to pull together a group called the Pacific Ballast Water Group to do just that, pull together a common sense regional approach to ballast water management on the coast. The Ballast Water Task Force made 12 recommendations, and the bill 3620 really addresses the most important of those recommendations, mainly to streamline the bill and allow us to accommodate potential treatment that would come on board ships in the near future, so that ships that are doing treatment of ballast water to remove organisms could discharge that water into Oregon without doing an exchange. The other element of the bill removes sediment from ballast water. Sediment accumulates in ballast water tanks, and there's really no way at this point without some specialized treatment technology that's being developed to remove that from the tank. So that was the reason for the recommendation for removing sediment from the bill.
Okay. We still don't have DEQ here with the amendment.
Mr. Chair, he's having some problems with the photocopier. So.
Pardon me?
He was having some problems with the photocopier.
There it is. Okay. We would have. Yeah. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Danka with the Department of Environmental Quality. Being passed out to you are some a couple changes that we three have agreed upon to the bill to make it workable and to address the fiscal that was going to be placed in our department. I can walk you through the three changes if you'd like.
Would you please?
The first change would be on page 2. The change would make the approval process be done with the federal government. It's probably more appropriate to tie it to the U.S. Coast Guard instead of having Oregon develop their own approval process. The second change would be on page 3 of the bill. We're not ready yet in this state to address sediment guidelines. We're not there yet. Maybe at a future date we should go there, but not right now. And then on the last change would be on a minor change on page 4, the last page of the bill, that would eliminate DEQ from paying expenses of this task force.
Okay.
With those three changes, the bill is acceptable to us, Mr. Chair.
And with those three changes, you think the significant fiscal would be removed?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll direct the... Well, let me go back. Do I have any questions, issues, concerns from the members of the committee with this? Do you understand what the changes are?
I do have a question.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, who is going to pay for it if the DEQ doesn't pay for it?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the task force functioned last biennium and during the interim quite well, with each member paying their own expenses to attend, and federal money and Portland State providing the staff assistance, and we think that'll work again this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I have a quick question.
Please.
Mr. Chair. Bob, are the task force members, since I don't remember who was on the task force last time, is this consistent with the membership from last? Is this just a continuation of the task force from last time, or is the membership different from last time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I believe this is exactly the same language that was in the bill that passed last session and created the task force during the interim. So really nothing has changed. It's a task force, again, looking at the issues and following up on some of the work they began but didn't finish.
Okay. Other? Thank you very much. We will submit these amendments to the Legislative Council, and we will intend to have a work session again on Thursday. At that particular work session, it is not the intention of the chair to have any invited testimony unless members of the committee have something specific. We would ask you to ask members of the committee to try to address those specific issues before we get to committee, because as you look at your Thursday schedule, you'll appreciate that you may be here till somewhere approaching it. I suppose we have to get out by midnight, otherwise we'll run into the next day. So, okay. Thank you very much. At this time, then, we will close the work session on House Bill 3620. And we will go down and open a work session on House Bill 3616. Mr. Tapp.
House Bill 3016 establishes property tax special assessment programs for wildlife habitat and land subject to conservation easements, permits homesite assessment of land under dwelling if associated with wildlife habitat assessment, applies to tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2004, permits location of dwelling on property subject to wildlife habitat or conservation easement special assessment upon compliance with certain requirements, authorizes State Department of Agriculture and State Board of Forestry to enter into stewardship agreements with landowners to create incentives for conservation, expedite permitting, regulatory certainty, and other stated benefits. There are amendments, and this has a prior referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Okay. Are there any questions on House Bill 3620? Any further explanation of it? I mean, since you've had this bill in your possession the better part of 15 or 20 minutes. We'll give you a couple of extra seconds to read and digest this bill while we close the work session on 3616. And I see that Representative Krieger is with us. And with that, I'd like to move to a work session on House Bill 3534. We'll open that work session. Representative Krieger.
Do you want me to read?
Yeah.
House Bill 3534 revises statutes relating to Ocean Policy Advisory Council, makes council part of State Department of Fish and Wildlife, makes State Department of Fish and Wildlife instead of Department of Land Conservation and Development liaison to National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration for a program with Center of Ocean Analysis and Prediction. Eliminates territorial sea plan. There are amendments to this bill, and I understand Representative Krieger has them and will explain them. And if you don't have copies in front of you, we'll get some from him and make them.
Okay. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Chair Jensen, committee members. The Dash 3 amendments are basically a rewrite of the entire bill. And I'll kind of tell you in a minute how we got there. For the record, my name is Wayne J. Krieger. I'm the state rep in District 1, Southern Oregon Coast. As with the bill I had before you last week, 3108, we have tried to have an open process, and as a result, we received recommendations from the following: Nat Evans, LCDC, Mr. Kafori from Audubon Society, numerous fishing groups, Mike Carrier State Parks, John Griffith County Commissioner, Jim Myrons from the Governor's Office has been instrumental in getting this thing moving, and Ono Husing from Oregon Coastal Zone Management. Most of the above I named were involved in a working group, and basically we redrafted the whole bill because it was so complex and things had been crossed out and added. and most all those people had concerns about certain parts, and we pretty well worked that out. One of the main issues was to where OPAC was going to be staffed and where they were going to be housed, and it was agreed to have them staffed in the governor's office, or placed in the governor's office, and be staffed by the Department of Fish and Wildlife along with LCDC, and then as needed, the governor could require the staff that he wanted. And we got to thinking about that. If it was an issue to do with DEQ, Division of State Lands or State Parks, more than likely he would take someone from their staff. If that was the issue that OPAC was working on, it would probably be a superior system to what we have now. They have direct input from the agency and have a staff person working on that issue. That was really, I think, the last major point, not really of contention, but debated how we're going to get it done. I think we've come to an agreement on that of those people that were present. The other issue that had come up was the membership of OPAC and its structure, where I had mentioned before I found it very unbalanced and did not really include many of the stakeholders. We now feel that we've got that straightened around to where that is not the case. Mr. Kafori had asked for two additional positions from the environmental community. The working group, in addition to trying to have a balanced council, desired to keep OPAC from becoming too large. It was agreed unanimously to reduce the three statewide positions to two and add one position for the environmental community. I think that was a reasonable compromise. I hope I haven't been able to talk to him since we've done that, but I will be doing that. I believe that as we move forward with this issue, we will have a better grassroots support for the issues of marine reserves and a meaningful input from all parties. And I think that will help marine reserves when they come to be accepted and to be a benefit to Oregon. I neglected last time to tell you the work and the number of people who directly support the effort we've made here. I have letters of endorsement from the bill from Lodging Association and Tourism, the Restaurant Association, Oregon Fishing and Guides, different groups, Oregon Fishing Groups, Brookings Harbor Port and Port Managers, commissioners from Tillamook County, Oregon Coastal Zone Management, the Grange, State Grange, Forest Industries Council, Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Association, League of Oregon Cities, Oregon Port Groups, Associated Oregon Loggers, Curry Economic Development, the Oregon Trawl Commission, commissioners from Lincoln County, and West Coast Seafoods. And I believe in the future we'll probably be getting a letter from the Port of Portland to support the efforts that we're making. So it's not something we've done in a vacuum. We brought a lot of people in, had a lot of discussion, and I think it'll be better for Oregon in the long term. Willing to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Myron, do you have any?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Jim Myron with the Governor's Office. First of all, I'd just like to thank Representative Krieger for his willingness to work through the issues surrounding this bill. We're comfortable, very comfortable with the Dash 3 amendments and support the bill with these changes. I would like to point out one particular issue on page 7 where we talk about the OPAC will be staffed by the Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Department of Land Conservation. We don't anticipate that this would add any fiscal to this bill because these agencies are already participating as part of OPAC, so they would just simply have a little bit different role in their participation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions for either Mr. Krieger, Representative Krieger, or Mr. Myron?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
I'm not sure where I'm going to speak here. So either one of you, since I've just gotten these and I'm not familiar with them, there was some testimony that was concerned about stripping away the protection of the ocean by removing the territorial sea plan. Is that still a part of the bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, no, we did not. It was the suggestion of Mr. Kefouri and some others in a conversation that rather than take it out, because we find there's some shortcomings in it, as I testified last time, the bill calls for OPAC to review the territorial sea plan and report back to the appropriate agencies of any considerations of change that they see needed. And I think that's probably being the territorial sea plan has been in place and has not been reviewed. It's probably a good idea to have that done, and that's, I think that was a great contribution.
Okay. And so are we...
Follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we still transferring the administration of the program from Department of Land Conservation and Development to ODF&W?
LCDC, Representative Tomei, still is the major agency for ocean policy. However, if it has to do with marine reserves that are created for the purpose of fishing regulations, bag limits, seasons, then that is the prerogative to that. That type of reserve would be established by the Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, please.
Representative.
All these new deletions, are those new or are those, were they in the old one too? Forgive me if I didn't.
Chair Jensen, Representative Schaffer, some of those are from the dash ones and twos.
Right.
And we rewrote the bill to show what's currently in there and what was taken out.
Yeah. That's why they pay me so much money.
Representative Schaffer?
Forgive me, Madam, Mr. Chair.
You're mumbling.
Sitting over here mumbling.
It's okay to mumble out loud, so we
just, Mr. Chair, I just don't like ever being in a hurry, I guess.
Representative Schaffer, the chair shares your concern about that. However, if you stay with this process for more than one session, you will find that it is that time when we are in a hurry.
Yes, sir.
Is there a better way to run the ship? That doesn't matter.
That's what the ballast water looks like.
Yeah. I'm dealing with the ballast water, I guess, on that. The chair would like to express his appreciation for Representative Krieger's really hard work on this bill, and for the fact that Representative Krieger kept the chair informed and provided him with far more reading material than he really wanted or needed.
Mr. Chair.
But we do appreciate it, and you are to be commended for your hard work on it.
Mr. Yes. Chair, thank you. There was a last session we were here, in the final session, we had a member with gray hair and a mustache who was setting center stage there that gave several young freshmen lessons in diplomacy. Diplomacy is the art of letting the other person have your way.
With that, Mr. Chair, I just want to say I have complete faith in Representative Krieger. He will not lead me astray. Nor the chair.
Please, Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, Jim Meyer again with the Governor's Office. I did want to take this opportunity to also thank Mike Carrier from the State Parks Department for his yeoman efforts in keeping this thing moving and getting a lot of the issues resolved.
Yes, I appreciate that. And I also would like to thank the Governor's Office for providing, help and resources and cooperation as we move through this process for this bill. So there are a lot of people who worked real hard on it, and we appreciate, their efforts to do so. We think it has addressed... this bill is addressing what were some of the major concerns that the people on the coast were having. We believe we'll have a better relationship there with the OPAC and the entire industry on the Oregon coast. So with that, the chair would entertain a motion unless there's other discussion.
Well, no, Mr. Chair, I was wondering if we were done hugging each other and ready to move the bill. I move the dash three amendment to House Bill 3534.
Representative Cruz moves the dash three amendment to House Bill 3534. Is there further discussion on that? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3534 as amended to the floor with. Is it going to place else?
No.
Okay. You never know. with a new pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3534 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Would you call a roll, please?
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative
Dahl.
Aye.
Representative
Mann.
Aye.
Representative
Dahl. Aye.
Representative
Trump.
Excuse
me. Chair Jensen. Aye. The chair assumes that Representative Krieger would like to carry this bill.
I would, Mr. Chair. And also, Mr. Chair, I enjoyed the hugging for a change.
On this bill, I can understand. Probably all of the folks that were involved enjoyed a little bit of hugging on this because we've had a little bit of a rocky road to go with it, and all of you are to be commended. Thank you. With that, the work session on House Bill 3534 is completed. And at that point, we will now... go back to House Bill 3616, and we had is this a bill where we ran it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We have some pros and cons, you know, with people on this. First off, I would invite. The members, Sarah Vickerman, Mike, I'm going to butcher the last name, Barsati.
Yeah.
Barsati.
And Ray Jengel, if you would, please. And help me with the last name. Okay, I'm sorry. Explain to us what this bill is, what this bill proposes to do, and why we're in work session on it. Well, I know we're in work session on it because the chair put it there, but other than that.
Chair Jensen, Mike Barsotti from the Department of Forestry. I'll give an overview. Sarah will talk about the bill itself, and Ray Janel from the Department of Agriculture will do the wrap-up.
About 7-8 minutes, you know. You don't
got it. Yeah, the 2001 legislature, via House Bill 3564, directed the Departments of Agriculture and Forestry to host an interim process to look at conservation easements, to see how, or to look at incentives, to see how incentives could be more effective. And two, to see if the Department of Forestry concept for stewardship agreements could be expanded across rural lands. The process we used, we invited all those landowner communities, agencies involved in natural resources, and interest groups and concerned about the management of our rural lands. We had a group of 30-some participations from variety of agencies and interest groups. It was facilitated through a grant with a dispute resolution. We worked through consensus as our strategy, worked on all issues until we could work them through to closure. You know, we provided a detailed report and a conservation incentive report, which I believe you all have a copy of. And with those issues where we had broad support, we brought those forward. Now, our goals that we used in this process were trying to remain revenue neutral, recognizing the current environment that we're in, try to expand just looking at our natural resources as an environmental or an ecological issue, but how to balance those different values into a common strategy, to integrate the approach across across individual disciplines, whereas currently, you know, our natural resources are managed by individual agencies responsible for particular disciplines. We recognize that Mother Nature is much broader than that, and we're trying to take approaches that reflect that. And also some of the past incentive strategies that we've used had unintentional consequences, and then where that was possible to try to remove some of those disincentives. With that, Sarah Vickerman would like to go through the bill itself.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Vickerman. I represent Defenders of Wildlife. I was involved in this process from the beginning, and also involved in House Bill 3564, which the legislature passed in 2001, directing us to go back and look at some of these issues. We basically dealt with three different programs in this bill. The first one is the Wildlife Habitat Conservation and Management Program that's administered by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And what 3616 does with that program is to completely rewrite it for the purpose of clarifying what the program does and how it works for landowners, for county assessors, and for the for local government. The intent of the group is to provide discretion for local governments to participate in this program or not, which is something they insisted on in order to go along with the other elements of the bill, and the group agreed to do that. The original draft of the bill did not do that because legislative council felt like there were constitutional issues associated with having some landowners have access to the program in Oregon and others not. And so the Dash 1 amendments that I believe most of you, if not all of you, have attempt to correct that issue by modeling a procedure that's similar to the enterprise zones used in the economic development activity. So those are the Dash 1 amendments. Those amendments, I should mention, do not accommodate some of the concerns of the cities and special districts, and we've had discussions with them and are willing to make those adjustments at a later date if the bill moves forward. Our intent was to make this program revenue neutral, and we believe we have largely done that through the proposed bill and amendments. Secondly, this bill dealt with conservation easements. Makes a very small but important change in the conservation easement program. These, by the way, conservation easements are already available to landowners strictly on a voluntary basis for them to work with third-party holders. What this bill does is that it clarifies special assessments to allow landowners to move freely between special assessments for agricultural uses, forestry uses, and conservation uses. Often these are integrated and occur on the same ownership, the same piece of property. So this simply makes it easier for the assessors. Most of this language was worked on and drafted by the Department of Revenue. Bruce Tindall, I believe, is in the room, did an excellent job. This does, easements, by the way, do allow active management for agriculture, for forestry, and for conservation purposes. Conservation easements don't lock up the land and keep it out of production. Finally, stewardship agreements. This bill rewards landowners who voluntarily do more than the law requires. What this bill does is expand the program from forest lands only to agricultural lands. Under this program, a landowner would contract with either the Department of Agriculture or the Department of Forestry as they so choose. Again, this is voluntary and revenue neutral, and it would require joint rulemaking by Department of Agriculture and Department of Forestry.
Good morning. My name is Ray Gendlin with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And there are several benefits to the farm and forest landowners as a result of this bill and this process. One is a broader range of non-regulatory tools for landowners to meet their own and society's objectives. There's improved understanding about common interest among participating groups. And there would be rewards to landowners who manage for multiple values. So those are the benefits that we see from this process and this bill. Bottom line is House Bill 3616 demonstrates progress toward more effective incentives of programs in these areas. The group that we had for this process built positive working relationships that will continue to pay dividends as we are able to work together, and it sets the stage for additional work toward more holistic resource management. Appreciate the opportunity to present this to you.
Are there any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. And I have one of the people, yes. Oh. I'm looking for Katie and Jean, but could you see if Katie's in place? Jean, we got him. Come here. Please go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The Oregon Farm Bureau, along with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, was part of the work group on House Bill 3616. I just want to say that I really appreciate the efforts by Defenders of Wildlife in bringing the groups together and talking about regulations and incentives and what their interests are versus what landowners' interests are, and trying to come together and have a meeting of minds as to incentives that landowners can be provided for future development of environmental benefits on private property. And we have very good discussions in lengthy meetings for many months, and I think those discussions were very beneficial, and we truly appreciate Defenders of Wildlife going in that direction and working with landowners to get a grip on what their needs are. Unfortunately, House Bill 3616 has taken a long time to come out of Legislative Council, so I'm trying to get grips right now as to our discussions during the group and how they match with what you see in the bill and in the amendments, which we just received this morning. Most of the bill has to do with special assessments and provides some needed clarity to this wildlife management planning that's administered by ODFNW that was passed during last session. And I think some beneficial clarifications are made in the bill. What I need to do at this point, I'm a little slow and I apologize for that in getting my homework done. I need to meet with Don Schellenberg, our other lobbyist that deals with special assessment issues and dwelling siting issues, just to provide clarity, go through the bill and make sure that there's nothing in there that the Farm Bureau would have an objection to. As to the special assessment that's created for conservation easements, we do have an objection to that. The only reason why a special assessment for conservation easements would be needed is if private property no longer qualifies for the farm use special assessment. We believe that farming can continue while providing environmental benefits. We do not support taking private property out of farmland production for those exclusive use of private property for environmental benefits. We think that the both can be done together. So to the extent that it would encourage or give additional benefits to taking farmland out of production and into conservation easements and granting a special assessment for that purpose, we would object to that. But again, I need to talk with Bruce Tindall, the expert on these issues, and go down through and see what substantive changes in law and in practice would come out of this bill. As to the stewardship agreement, which is the last portion of the bill, we did get together and talk about ways where landowners could benefit from going above and beyond regulatory compliance, and what benefits could we potentially provide to landowners that want to use their own private resources and their own property for more environmental benefits on the land. And we support whatever additional incentives or benefits could be provided to those types of landowners. And the structure is put in the bill. We'll have to see in practice with Department of Agriculture and the rules that they provide how that will come out and whether additional incentives actually will be provided, such as higher ranking for Farm Bill funding, for example. Federal Farm Bill funding would be something that a landowner could potentially benefit from making a commitment to going above and beyond the call of duty, so to speak. So we do need to get assurance from Farm Bureau's membership that we have no further objections to the bill, and I commit to working on that in the short term in a hurry. Thank you.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. Katie Fass with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. As Jean mentioned, I also served on the working group during the interim. However, the cattlemen are in opposition of 3616, mainly due to the conservation easement tax assessment, which Jean explained. The cattlemen are not opposed to conservation easements. We actually are aligned with Oregon Rangeland Trust that is working to help ranchers put easements on their operations. However, we are concerned with promoting a program through tax assessments that would take land out of production. Another concern I have with the legislation is an agreement that the work group brought forth allowing counties to opt in and out of the Wildlife Habitat Conservation Program. That was a big issue with a lot of our members as legislation was passed last session that counties had a certain time where they would decide if they could enter into the program, and then they were locked in the program for perpetuity. An agreement with the working group would allow counties to opt in and out of the program with their discretion. There were safeguards for landowners entering into programs or interested in entering into the wildlife habitat conservation program. We would like to see that piece added back into the legislation. However, I have concerns with a piece of legislation that this complicated coming out so late in the session that it has enough time to be adequately worked by all the interest groups to come up with something that is good and safe legislation. So I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Sarah. In addressing Katie's concern about the counties opting in and out, do you have a problem with what her request would be on that?
Mr. Chairman, Sarah Vickerman, for the record. No, I believe we fixed that problem with the Dash 1 amendments. At least we attempted to. We fixed it relative to the county's participation, and as I mentioned when I was up here a couple of minutes ago, that we're more than willing to make additional adjustments to accommodate the cities and special districts that have the same concern. They just didn't want to be included in the program over their objections on the chance that it might have an adverse impact to their revenue.
Okay. Would you or talk with these people and see whether your concern on that issue has been met? And not right now. But
yeah, I'd be happy to, Chair Jensen. And I just briefly looked over the Dash 1s. I haven't had time to
I'd realize
study them.
Questions for...
I have one maybe question observation, and this is more for Jean. From what I understand of the bill, like many of the conservation tools that we have available, this would be another tool in the toolbox available. And I just want to make sure that I'm clear, because I heard some concerns about taking land out of production. My understanding is this tool would be just for willing landowners. I mean, farmers who don't want to participate in the program would not be forced to participate in the program. Am I understanding that right? So it's a landowner who says that, you know, we want to take our land out of production and get some tax benefits where it could through this program.
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, that's absolutely right. And it is another tool in the toolbox. However, Farm Bureau takes a more of a global approach when it comes to protecting farming on private farmland. And so we scrutinize pretty heavily incentives that are provided for taking farmland out of production. And right now, you can have a conservation easement on your property, but if you keep it in farm production, you still get your farm use assessment. If your property no longer qualifies for that farm use assessment, and Bruce at Department of Revenue is to tell you all about this. But if you no longer qualify for that because you aren't farming the property and you're leaving it idle or dedicating it to wildlife habitat, then you're subject to back taxes and having it assessed differently. And so I think what this bill proposes is to provide an additional special assessment for conservation easements. And so in our view, that provides an incentive for people rather to lay conservation easements, if they're voluntarily doing that, over farmland and keep that farmland in some kind of farm use, that is something that we approve of. And in those circumstances, a special conservation easement assessment would not be needed. So we want to discourage folks from entering into a situation where farmland is taken out of production and left strictly for wildlife management.
Can I have a follow-up? Okay.
Follow-up.
Now, the question is, Jean, my understanding, there's CRP, we have a number of tools already available where that happens. So I'm just trying to understand, do you have a particular objection to this tool, or is it just in general? Because, I mean, the CRP program, basically, you're taking land out of production and minor, you know, not for in perpetuity, but under contractual basis.
That's absolutely right, Representative Dingfelder. That is a contract with the federal government where it is for a period of 10 years, generally speaking. And so it isn't a permanent transition from out of farmland production. A conservation easement, I think that they can be done in different ways, but typically conservation easements are in perpetuity. So you're forever taking farmland out of production. And Farm Bureau has established policy long ago where we are opposed to permanently taking farmland out of production for any reason, whether it's building homes on, whether it's developing, for any reason. We need to maintain our infrastructure areas in the state where farmland is kept in farmland production.
Okay. Thank you. Sarah, did you have a comment on that?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate it. The important point here is that a conservation easement doesn't necessarily take land out of production, that a conservation easement can cover the full range of management options from land that's used 100% for production from edge to edge, or land that's partially used for production and perhaps has an important wildlife area that isn't used. It can be mixed. Wild rice, for example, is good habitat during some time of the year and also produces a crop. And whether that land is taken out of production, or if so, to what extent it's taken out of production is entirely the choice of the landowner and the third party that holds the easement, which is already permissible under Oregon law. So this is just a recommendation from the Department of Revenue how to keep the assessors from having to apply potentially two sets of, in some cases, rare cases, conflicting criteria about whether land is strictly used for agriculture production or strictly for conservation purposes. So in general, most of the time, especially with large ownerships, it would be mixed. So there would be production on part of the parcel and perhaps some part of it used for conservation purposes, which is entirely consistent with the federal Farm Bill programs, a number of them, as you mentioned, CREP, more recently for riparian protection. So it's entirely the landowner's choice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, if I can make one more comment. That is why we need to sit down quickly with Bruce, perhaps, and maybe we can reach an understanding or a middle ground or something so that the lobbyist I'm concerned with the Farm Bureau is Don Schellenberg, to get his buy-off, so to speak, on this area, or get with certainty his objections to it in whole or in part. And I'm willing to do that.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. And, colleagues, let me tell you what the chair is proposing to do with this bill. First, I'm proposing that I need a resolution that Katie's concern about the counties in and out is in fact, addressed by the bill. I need that issue to be clarified. Secondly, I do agree with Ms. Fass' concern or issue about this is a large and complex bill, and the time that we have to work it is short at very best. It's seeming to me that the one portion of the bill that is in some controversy is the easement portion. I have generally said as we go into this last day or two of committee hearings that the only bills that really move forward are those where all the ducks are in a row, where everybody is in agreement on the issues and there is concern there. There's a need to address that issue, and I don't believe we have time left in this session to address it. So I'm going to ask Legislative Council, and I'd like to work with the folks who have brought this bill forward, to remove the easement portion of the bill and let us move forward with it without that portion for this time. Between now and next session, I'm sure the folks who are proponents here for this will not let the hard work go by the wayside that's taken place, and will work with the Farm Bureau and other interested cattlemen, other interested groups, to make sure that this issue is addressed and that everybody is happy with it. So that's the direction that we would like to take on it. I'd like to have members of the committee inform me, not here, but in my office, if you're uncomfortable with that and will be unable to vote for it, so that we will be able to either move this in or out very quickly in our Thursday meeting. Okay? With that, the work session then on House Bill 3616 is closed for today. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. What's our next? House Bill 2253 modifies the and restructures fees for DSL, removal and fill program. Test.
House Bill 2253 modifies restructured schedule of fees for Division of State Lands removal and fill program, exempts habitat restoration projects from removal fill permit fees, subjects emergency authorizations for removal and fill permit fee structure, allows 45 days to submit payment after emergency authorization, establishes fee for action under general authorization, declares emergency effective July 1, 2003. There are sets of amendments that you should have in your folder, the dash twos. And I don't believe we need the dash ones, which we had earlier to this, but I'm sure that the dash ones are still the same. So we have dash ones moved into the dash twos. That's the bill up for us. It's a work session. We've heard it several times. It has a prior referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. I'd like to hear from the department. John, want to come up? Want to walk us through the amendments, please?
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. I'm John Lilly, the Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands. You have before you the Dash 2 amendments. As when I was before you last, we discussed these in part. And since our last meeting, I've since talked with one of the objectors to the bill, Mr. Tom Quintel, representing a placer miner, and made another proposed change in the bill, which is represented in the dash two amendments. But if I may, I'll walk through quickly the dash twos. We add on page two to the bill a number of categories for cost for the permit based upon volume of fill and removal total. Remove from the bill any reference to cost recovery as a method of assigning the application fee, and replace that with these four additional categories, and top out the total cost of the volume fee at $2,500. So for any project in excess of 25,000 yards, the cost would be $2,500 plus the base fee, which would be the same for all applications. Secondly, we make a minor change on page 3 in lines 10 and 11, where we change the wording of that particular segment that refers to no application fee for habitat restoration projects, to just make it clear that the habitat restoration projects are to be defined by rule by the director. The remaining changes are simplifying without great substance. It refers to the renewal fee being the base fee amount, which is $300. Then on pages 6 and 7, this is the change that was made as a result of further discussion. What we're proposing is in the instance when the division and the director decides by rule to require a fee for a general authorization, which is an expedited permit, then if the project being applied for is less than 50 cubic yards, there would be no fee required. No application fee whatsoever would be required.
The question. Comments? Are you happy or unhappy?
I actually have a question for John regarding how does this affect overall, you know, how much fees you will be recovering? Because when you originally testified on this bill, it said that through the fee increase, you could add $417,000 to the Common School Fund, according to my notes. So how does this adjustment affect how much we're going to be putting back in the Common School Fund if this goes forward?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, we've done some calculation, and keep in mind that we're trying to forecast the future and apply a new fee schedule against what might happen in the future by looking back in the past and the way that the different volumes of permits have come in. And since we've changed from this cost recovery perspective to the flat fee categories, it seems like our best guess is about a push. In other words, it'll be about $417,000 would be our best guess estimate of what we would have under this revised program.
More or less.
Yes, sir, more or less. As best we can estimate.
Thank you.
You're using the same economist that the
<So
fun.
laughs>
Well, just a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Any other? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And Tom Quintal has asked if he could say a word or two on this. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. My name is Tom Quintel, a resident of Salem, small-scale placer miner. I support the new amendment on House Bill 2253 to assess a fee for any action in excess of 50 cubic yards conducted under the general authorization. And I'll offer support and work with the Division of State Lands to encourage additional streamlining of the new streamlined GA permit. The new 2003 streamlined version of the GA permit will reduce administrating time by reducing paperwork and eliminating duplication, increasing certainty and timeliness, and enhanced resource protection. And then I also have a couple ideas, and I think I've mentioned them before, and I'll just go over it real quick. Some additional ideas of streamlining could include printing up a small booklet to include Division of State Lands removal fill rules, possibly including the DEQ turbidity regulations and Oregon Fish and Wildlife work schedule pertaining to suction dredging in Oregon waters. And this booklet, of course, could be mailed out by request or distributed to various agencies, Bureau of Land Management, and so forth. This basically is how Washington currently is doing their permit, and it's been distributed over the past several years very, very well. And, of course, Mr. Chapman, who wrote the permit, the hydraulic project approval permit, feels that it's a really good system, and I put his phone number in there for you if possibly you wanted to contact him. The other idea I had, too, is obtaining permits through the website would really be a quick and efficient way to do, and I believe they're working on that process currently. So those are just some of the ideas that would probably help further eliminate any problems with issuing permits. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Quintel? Okay. We have a member on this.
Do you want a motion? Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2551 with the dash two amendments to House Bill 2551 for adoption.
We've been in the wrong bill, I think.
Oops, am I in the wrong bill?
Aren't we on 2250?
Oh, sorry about that.
Representative Dinkfelder moves the dash two amendments
to House Bill
2253.
Thank you.
Is there any discussion or objection?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2253 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Representative Dingfelder moves House Bill 2253 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Are you sure you didn't mean with no recommendation?
I'm ready to recommend it.
Okay. Call the roll.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Excuse me.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder.
Aye.
Representative Krupp.
Excuse
me. Chair Jensen.
Representative Cruz is here.
Study in PSL.
Representative
Cruz. Just say yes. Everybody likes it. Everyone is happy. Going to take them out.
You waiting for my vote on something?
Mm. Okay. If I make it easier, the chair's not going to vote for it.
Yeah, I'm a no.
No. You need to call my name, though.
Chair Jensen?
No. Okay. House Bill 2253 moves to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Okay. We've got next up on our agenda, House Bill 2431. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2431. Mr. Tess.
House Bill 2431 allows persons seeking permit to remove material from or fill waters of the state to pay money into Oregon's Midland Mitigation Bank revolving fund account instead of obtaining permit, specifies replacement ratio for mitigating wetland losses, specifies the Director of Division of State Lands has the burden to prove that wetlands exist on property for which the permit is sought, allows person to seek writ of mandamus to force Division of State Lands to make final decision on permit application after 90 days. There are a set of amendments to this bill that eliminate most of the clauses, and I believe the proponent of the amendment is in the audience, Mel Stewart, that might explain the amendment. Basically, the bill and all of what I read is null and void after the amendment.
No, the amendment is a proverbial gut and stuff?
Pretty close.
Okay. Mr. Seward, please. I don't have any time. Briefly, Mr. Seward, please.
Okay. My name is Mel Stewart. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, in the Dash 5 amendments, we've deleted sections 1 through 9 of the original bill, We have changed, made some minor wording changes on sections 10 through 14, and everything else was removed. What's remaining in the bill is about five changes to existing state law. The first changes the period for both applicant and non-applicant objectors to a permit decision. For applicants, the current standard is 10 days, and that's going to be changed to 21 days. For non-applicants, i.e. a neighboring property owner, the current standard is 60 days, and that's also going to be changed to 21 days, so that all parties, no matter what side of a fence they live on, are given the same timeline for appealing a permit decision. Next item. Clarifies existing policy that, you know, if there's a dispute over the completeness of an application, that can also be appealed to the hearings officer for a decision. We also, have a burden of proof issue, and we require mitigation to be proportional to the functional values that were being removed from the site, so that you have to, whatever you take away, you have to replace, but you don't have to do anything more than that, and the burden of proof is upon the state, and that is consistent with the Dolan v. Tigard decision. So we bring that down from what could be a circuit court action to the hearings officers. Jurisdiction. We also eliminate the 45 days of extended review after the hearings officer makes a decision. Currently, after the hearings officer makes a decision, that decision is then referred back to the director for an additional 45 days of review. We make the hearings officer's decision, final and the end of the issue. We also add some clarity to the rules of discovery, part of which are already in rule, but we also add the additional provision that all parties to the proceeding must be allowed the same opportunity for discovery. Everybody gets treated equally. And on page 6, what you'll see if you're from local government is essentially the 120-day rule that currently applies to local government for their decision-making timeline. Local government has a specific timeline in which they have to make decisions, and that's applies to cities and counties. It's currently under ORS 227, and we gave that to legislative council and asked him to use that as a model for preparing a timeline for DSL's decision-making, and that's what we have there. I'd like to, finally, in closing, I'd like to draw your attention to ORS 197.805, Policy on Review of Land Use Decisions. It is the policy of the Legislative Assembly that time is of the essence in reaching a final decision in matters involving land use, and that those decisions be made consistently with sound principles governing judicial review. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Stewart? Thank you, Mr. Stewart. I think John Lilly with the Department of State Lands wanted to provide us his update on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Lilly, Assistant Director, Division of State Lands. Mr. Stewart did provide us with copies of the Dash 5s, and we have reviewed them. Just quickly, I wanted to cover a couple of points and then make my final comment. One is, last session, Senate Bill 529 was passed. Senate Bill 529 basically told the agency that it must make a decision on the completeness of an application within 40 days. Once that decision is made, then the agency has 90 days to make the permit decision. So we are tied to very strict standards and time in order to make decisions. We have no objection to the portion of the bill of the Dash 5s that deal with
the contested case provisions for differences of opinion over the completeness of an application. We do object to all other aspects of the bill as being redundant to existing law and to the allowances for applicants as it currently exists. For example, if the agency fails to act within 120 days, then the applicant has full rights authority to go to the courts to force the agency to act, just as proposed in the bill. We think that's redundant to put it into the law. And then finally, an item that Mr. Stewart didn't mention, but that he and I spoke to about in the hallway, is on page 4, line 9 of the bill, or of the dash 5s. This is the section of the statute that deals with the time period for completeness review. Currently, as I stated, the law says that the agency has 40 days. Mr. Stewart's original proposal was 14. He has told me that he is comfortable with 30 days, and the agency is comfortable with 30 days. So we would ask that you consider that.
Mel.
I would be happy with 30 days.
Mr. Stewart, again for the record, please.
My name is Mel Stewart, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. I would be comfortable with 30 days.
Mr. Loy brings up a couple of other concerns that he has. You work with Mr. Lilly today and get any other amendments? You've heard me say that I want to have all my ducks in a row.
Sure.
On these bills when we go into this particular time. And I'd like to know if you'd sit down and try to work with Mr. Lilly today. You've heard his concerns that he had, and see if those can be addressed then if so, then we'll try to get amendments worked for them so that we can be back in here on Thursday and do perhaps a simple yes and no vote, straight up vote in the committee.
Okay.
Can that be done?
Okay.
Okay, yes, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Question.
Thank you. Mr. Lilly, Mr. Stewart mentioned in his materials that he presented to us that there had been a contested case that has run for over 3.5 years, and you had talked about the limit and time that the agency has. Can you address that, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I'm not personally familiar with all of the details of that particular contested case. In general, I know that oftentimes cases run as a result of both parties, both the state and the appellant, if you will, wanting more time to review records. And so an ultimate decision, or rather an ultimate argument in front of the hearings officer, is postponed while all these procedural things are done. It's a quasi, what I would call a quasi-judicial process, the contested case process, and so there are motions and cross motions for discovery, opportunities for both parties to look at records and produce records, and sometimes that takes time for those things to go on. In addition, sometimes an appellant may take time to, while they serve notice that they have an appeal, they may take time to mature and explain what they're actually appealing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Representative Shockley.
So if I get you right, Mr. Lilly, many of the things that are asked for in here were taken care of in legislation last session. What I would like to ask you is how many applications do you do process a year? And over the last 4 years, we can just multiply that by four. And then over the last 4 years, how many are still contested in the court or an appeals process or anywhere at all? And I'm asking that because no matter what kind of process we put together, we're not going to make everybody happy. So if I could get some idea of where the numbers we're working on here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, off the top of my head, we issue somewhere in the neighborhood of 800 to 1,000 general authorizations and individual permits annually. Of those, we may have, over the last 3 to 4 years, a total of, say, 15 to 20 contested cases and very rarely do we have a situation that actually goes into the court system. But right now, I think we have about 10 active contested cases, and they range from people other than the applicant who are contesting the decision, to the applicant, to someone who may be found to be potentially in violation of the removal fill law and who has chosen to contest the agency's order through the contested case process. So it's not always a contested case over a permit action.
And may I follow up just briefly?
Follow up.
And do you think that these the timelines that have been established with the last session's legislation will that help avoid some of these appeals or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I think that did certainly well, because I think one of the things that frustrates applicants and one of the reasons why Senate Bill 529 was necessary is there were not clear standards as to what we have for a complete application. And so folks unfortunately got caught in maybe a bring me a rock exercise. And so that took time for people to put their application together, a frustration set in, and there really now I think we have a much better, you afforded us a much better system to say, okay, this is when the application is complete, this is what's required. I think there's less frustration and anxiety in that manner. And under our own administrative rules, we've said that if we don't take action within the 40 days as currently allowed by law, we accept the application as presented.
Thank you.
Representative Cook, you were the person who brought this bill forward, I think. Based on what we have here and what the testimony is, the chair's interested if you're going to be comfortable with the bill as it exists right now, or as perhaps I'm proposing that they try to work out some of the difficulties between the agency and Mr. Stewart.
I think, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that consideration, I think that some reasonable accommodation can be made here. I'm just reading through the Dash 5 amendments right now, and I'm assuming there will be some additional, based on what our discussion has been the last few minutes, some additional changes. From my standpoint, Mr. Chair, I'd like to see the policy implication of this move forward, because I think it is critical that on these issues that the agency respond in a timely manner. And I think that's really is the crux of Mr. Stewart's entire issue all along. And if we can reach an agreement that is workable for the agency in terms of this policy and is acceptable to Mr. Stewart, then I'm fine with it.
Thank you. I'll try to get this and get anything for amendments to me, obviously, quickly, because we don't have a lot of time until Thursday.
Okay.
And LC is busy, so make them simple. Pardon me, Mr. Chair.
They already hate us.
That's okay. That's what we get paid for, is to make people in the LC hate us. Thank you.
That's why we earn the big money, Mr. Chair.
Right, yeah, that's right. Let's see, where are we? House Bill 2364. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2331. Open the work session on 2364. Mr.
Chair. House Bill 2364 repeals laws relating to wetlands, repeals Oregon Wetlands Mitigation Bank Act of 1987, repeals statewide wetlands inventory system, repeals wetlands conservation plan statutes, repeals wetlands fill and removal statutes.
Okay. Pete, who do we have to testify?
We have Glenn Stonebrink. Glenn, you want to come forward, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Stonebrink. I'm with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and on this bill, I'm also speaking for the Oregon Hay and Forage Association. What we have in Oregon is a situation where people who own private property, and they wish to do something on their private property, but they have part of it is deemed to be wetlands by two governments, then that individual landowner must go to two governments to get two separate permits dealing with two separate regulations that may not coincide. Last session, there was an attempt with a bill, Senate Bill 172, and we supported that bill, which would try to would allow the Division of State Lands to assume the permitting process and, of course, the regulatory process from the federal government, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. I worked in that work group from that time until there was a point in which we discovered that the Division of State Lands, we asked them to say, if you're going to take over the federal government's permitting process, let's be no more restrictive than what the federal government is. We have to be at least that restrictive, but let's not be any more than that. That didn't happen. And so at the present time, that assumption process, there's been hearings on it in the Senate, and that assumption process is virtually dead. So what I'm asking for today is to get to an alternate solution to where we only have to deal with one government, one set of regulations, and one fee. And that would be to have the Division of State Lands step aside in the wetlands process. We still have to, the people on private property with wetlands still have to deal with the federal government. But we would only be dealing with one government, one fee, one set of regulations. Now, if this were to happen, it happens to have some economic benefits to the state. When I testified in Ways and Means on Natural Resources, I found that the wetland cost to the Division of State Lands to the state was approximately $2.9 million. The permits, the fees from the permits, brings in $200,000. I'm dealing in round figures. Now, it was interesting during that time that I was testifying that a gentleman from the school administrators association said, well, you know, they'd like to have the fees raised to meet the cost because we're talking about school funds when we're talking with the Division of State Lands, and this is a drain on the school fund. Well, if you do the math, that means you'd have to raise the fees on private property owners 15 times to match just the cost, just to break even. Now, what would happen if you have the Division of State Lands step aside and let the federal government deal with it only? Then you'd have a net savings of $2.7 million. So we'd ask for your approval of this bill and let it get into Ways and Means and get the final fiscal on it. But those are the numbers that I got from when we were talking about Division of State Lands budget.
Any members' questions? Glenn, you made a statement that the assumption process in the Senate appears to be dead. Has there been no movement on that recently?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't elaborate on that just in the essence of time, but the old Senate Bill 172 had a provision that the process had to be worked out and then brought back to this body in this year, this session of the legislature, for final approval. There were two bills, 219 was one, I forget the other one. Anyway, there were two bills in the Senate. We've had a hearing on that. I know I testified from the cattlemen against the bill, and there was some other opposition to the bill. And then I saw a letter from the director of Division of State Lands that said that they would not like to have further consideration of those bills at this time because they wanted to work on the process more. And maybe next session they could come back. But in the meantime, we still have landowners dealing with this. So to make it simple and to save money. I guess that's the bottom line.
Okay. Thanks, Glenn. Appreciate it. Liz Frankel, would you come forward, please?
Welcome, thank you very Liz. Much. I'm Liz Frankel, representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. In addition, I would like to speak for myself. And the reason for the myself part is history. And I am old enough, so I've got a lot of it. I helped establish the law which allows Oregon Wetland Mitigation Bank. I want to bring that to your attention for a very interesting reason. There is a significant cottage industry in this state involved with wetland banks. People who have are developing wetland banks, and these are really a big investment. They're an investment that have to be made in advance of being able to sell the credits from the banks, but those credits sell for quite a lot, and they're very valuable. This is an interesting industry in the state. You have Eugene, the city of Eugene, that has developed a statewide wetland inventory, conservation plan, etc. Again, this is an interesting, and I helped develop all of those. Eugene has actually worked out a very good plan whereby they have been able to move forward with development, roads, etc., with a wetland conservation plan. A lot of these things, what I'm saying, they work. And I'm not sure when other people refer to economic impact, if maybe one would have to look more carefully into what the economic impact is of, for example, protecting wetlands in Oregon in terms of their value in terms of clean water, their value in slowing flooding, in dispersing flooding, and this is one of the more interesting ones, cleaning up pollution, which is something wetlands do. That's the personal history part. Back to the League of Women Voters, we strongly support not only regulating wetlands on the federal level, but if a state chooses to do their own regulation, there are means to do that. The state is considering that. At this point, destroying the entire program makes absolutely no sense, and we would oppose the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Liz. Questions?
I have a question.
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks, Liz. One of the concerns I have is that there are some differences now with some rule changes, regulation changes, actually due to some court cases between our federal regulations and state regulations. Can you maybe address how that works in Oregon? Because we do have...
Yes, at the present moment...
Some different...
I assume you're referring to the fact, and the deadline, as a matter of fact, is today. The federal EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, has issued draft rules. The comment period closes today. The draft rules have to do with the Swank decision, and I don't want to go into all of that because it's way more complicated than is necessary, I think. But it does affect isolated wetlands. It affects wetlands that are not connected to other wetlands. It would affect, for example, in the Medford area, the famous wetlands near Medford that are these little vernal pools, which provide incredible, incredible diversity of vegetation. These are wetlands. They would not be necessarily protected if... It depends on how those rules come out, because there's still a lot of... The legal decision is not clear at all. It will be clarified in terms of these EPA rules, so we really don't know. But this is critical because Oregon does protect isolated wetlands. So we have a lot to lose. It's why you will have a lot of people very concerned, very caring about these little wetlands. And as Dr. Paul Adamus says, and he is probably the guru of all wetland experts, bigger doesn't necessarily mean better. Little doesn't necessarily mean no good in terms of wetlands. Does that help?
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Liz.
Thank you.
Ann Hannis. Ann, if you'd come forward, Division of State Lands.
Hi.
And if John would like to come forward, that's fine too. John, if you want to come on up. Welcome to you both again for the record.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Ann Hannis, Director of the Division of State Lands. I'm here to speak on House Bill 2364. Also with me is John Lilly, who's the Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands. We are opposing this bill because we believe that it's contrary to the direction that the state of Oregon is heading, and that is for having a single state and federal permitting system at the state level that provides us with more local control about how we regulate waterways and wetlands, and it also would impact the protection of our waterways and wetlands, which are important for water quality, flood control, and protection of property. This also would, I think, be contrary to the letter that was provided to the chair from Jim Brown, who's the governor's natural resource policy director, that any legislation on these matters would need to have broad support and it would not compromise our ability to assume federal wetland permitting authorities. By the way, with regard to that, we are very close to getting a statewide programmatic general permit from the Army Corps of Engineers, which would cover about 60% of our permits. With regard to 404 assumption, I did send a letter to the chair of the Senate committee asking to hold off on any action on 404 assumption because we wanted to work on concerns that were raised by the agricultural community on their exemptions. So we'd like to work in the month ahead on that and then bring a more complete package back to the 05 legislature on 404 assumption, which would then allow us to assume the complete program and provide more state control over what we do in terms of regulation. It would also, our hope would be that it would provide assurance to property owners that they would then be able to have compliance with the Federal Endangered Species Act and not have to deal with a variety of different federal and state agencies. I think going to regulating only to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers would be counter to trying to focus and streamline our permitting process. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mr. Chair. Representative Krupp. Thank you. Ann, do you agree that the process, 404 assumption process in the Senate is active or is it dead?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, I believe for this session, 404 is not moving forward for legislative action.
And Mr. Chair, if I may,
please, Representative.
Does that not create some problems here in that the statute says, if that's accurate from prior testimony, that this legislative session is supposed to deal with this issue?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, the statute actually talks about coming back at the odd years of legislation. It doesn't specify that we have to be and get approval during the 03 session. So we can come back in 05. And when we looked at our timeline, we felt that we needed the time in working with EPA and working with the constituents to make sure we had as complete a package to show the legislative body as possible.
Okay, and last question, Mr. Chair. If we pass this legislation out and it did have significant savings as a result of the process being further examined in Ways and Means, do you agree that it would save a significant amount of money, and how would that affect your agency?
Representative Jensen, Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, it would save money for the Common School Fund because right now the fees, current fees, cover only about 15% of the cost of the program. And that's why the bill that you had acted on earlier would increase the share that fees cover of the program. However, there would be other costs to others that wouldn't be captured by that. For example, by not having protection for flood control and for water quality, that would increase the cost to local governments in terms of their water quality efforts and sewage and water control. It would also make it more difficult and confusing for developers as they try to deal with the number of regulations and the various different entities than what we would hope to have under a streamlined process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Amen.
Other questions of the department? Okay. What's your pleasure?
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a fairly significant change.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that I have to say I find some merit in the concept of I find merit in both arguments, I have to say, and I am undecided at this point. I think that if we can save the money, that's always good in this particular budget environment. But I have to say, if it makes it harder for people to obtain permits and work through the system with the federal government, that's obviously problematic. On the other hand, I see it as if we continue status quo, it seems to me that there's a certain disincentive for all the parties in the 404 assumption process to come together and get this thing figured out. I mean, we could drag this on forever. And in the same time, you still do not have a concise, consolidated, one-stop process. And so the continued confusion that reigns today will only continue. So I guess I need a little more time to mull this over from my perspective, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
I believe that's your bill, isn't it?
Which bill are we on?
This is 2364.
2364 is Representative Smith's bill.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
There are certain aspects of this bill that I like. Certain others I have problems with. Wetland fill and removal clearly is an issue. At the same time, I'm not sure I necessarily want to repeal the state wetlands inventory because it has some flexibility that the federal inventory does not have. And because the federal inventory is just a satellite infrared mapping system, and that anything that shows up as wetlands, whether there's viability or not, and so I'm not sure that the total repeal is where we need to be going here, because I think there are some tools that we should still have in play. At the same time, to have to go through two permitting processes makes absolutely no sense. So I guess I'm kind of in the same boat Representative Krupp is. I haven't really spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I'm wondering if there are parts of this that we should move forward with and parts of it we should leave alone.
Mr. Chair, I have to say I like many of the things that we've tried to achieve in Oregon in terms of wetland mitigation banking. I like that concept. I like, because I think it's a proactive concept. But one of the great barriers to Oregon's economy and siting a business here or building a building in some places is this whole issue of wetlands. And it's just another one of those barriers that creates difficulty for us as a state in trying to attract or re-expand our economy, which is the whole problem we have right now in our budget. Somehow we have got to get to the place where we force a consolidated permitting process in many areas. And this is just one of them. There are so many others all across the state. And I'm troubled that we have to have a dual permitting process and a dual track here. And I thought that was what our effort that has been ongoing for some time now was trying to get at. I think at the very least we should put an absolute date certain when the 404 assumption process has to be concluded. To leave it open-ended is that's actually a surprise to me. I didn't realize. I thought it was mandated we had to fix this problem now, but apparently not.
Thank you. You know, I have to agree the permit process is a mess. and the short time I've been here, I think all we really do is in this building is keep a handle on the confusion. I'm for streamlining and fixing the permit process and trying to go to one building for it rather than the state and the feds. But I can't say that this is the vehicle to do it with as it is either. Thank you.
Does this have such court referral?
It does.
Ways.
Okay. Well, it brings up an interesting dynamic. If, Ms. Chair, if we were to send this to Ways and Means, it would end up in the subcommittee that Representative Greg Smith sits on, I believe. And maybe at that point in time they could dissect and pull pieces out of this that are relevant to the direction they're wanting to go. So that's a possibility here. I mean, clearly I don't know that we have the time frame before us to really sit down and do the dissection necessary here. Like I said, there are parts of this I like, parts of it I'm not quite sure that we should be going to. So,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Forage and then Representative Dinkle.
Thank you. I guess I'm conflicted as well, but I think it might be an interesting exercise to see what Ways and Means would come up with as far as the economic impact in the event this whole bill or parts thereof were to be implemented.
Representative Dinkle.
Mr. Chair, the concern I have is that we are the policy committee, and our job is to look at the substantive elements of this bill. I do have a concern about, obviously, repealing our program and that the message that this sends. And actually, to respond to Representative Krupp, since I've done quite a bit of permitting as a private consultant, I will tell you that we actually have more certainty through our state program, I hate to say, than our federal program as far as time certain. You know, we have in state rules now, as we've heard, that a landowner has to get a response within a certain amount of time. We don't have that same certainty under the federal program. And I've actually had a lot more challenges, so to speak, working with the Corps and getting response to my permits and through with Division of State Land. So I won't be supporting the bill because I actually think we'll do a greater disservice to landowners. I did support the 404 assumption, Senate Bill 172, I think it was last session. If I'm hearing right, Director Hannes said that we would still be going forward with the SVGP program that would address about 60% of our permits. So one thing I just want to make clear for the committee, that there's two elements to our permitting program, and we actually will move forward with the general permit portion, which will address, as we heard, about 60% of the permits that come forward, and we won't be moving forward with the 404 at this time. I did support that. The concern I did have is the fact that it will take additional resources to assume the 404 program.
which we will not get from the feds. If we assume the program, we don't get any additional funding, which is a concern, as we just heard the DSL fee bill. We're still only covering, even if the fee bill passes Ways and Means, only 25% of the cost of that program. The rest of it's funded through general fund. So I do have some concerns about it, and if we move forward, I'll be a no vote.
Well, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, if we think this bill has merit, clearly the Ways and Means Subcommittee can spend more time on it in the coming weeks, frankly, then. Our mandate is to be finished by the end of the week. So if we think that there's worthy further discussion and the bill could be amended in some form to be useful, then we probably ought to send it down there. If we don't think it's a concept worthy of consideration, then we probably ought to just stay here.
Okay. Having heard the discussion and appreciate all of your positions, well thought positions, I might add with it, the chair's not inclined to move the bill forward today, either to Ways and Means or any other way. I do have a certain amount of a certain amount of sympathy with the intent of the bill. I think one of the things that bothers me, quite a bit, is the fact that we've got a department that initially was created as a non-regulatory department and has subsequently been given a number of regulatory functions. Generally speaking, the ability of an organization to serve two masters is very difficult, and they usually wind up serving the master that puts the most, if you wish, pressure on them. I have as many of you have spoken so well in this committee about the Common School Fund and protecting the Common School Fund. It's my own personal feeling that I'd be much more comfortable if the Division of State Land spent more time making money with the Common School Fund than with some of the other regulatory functions that they and I'm not blaming the existing personnel in the department for this. These are functions that have been added to their workload over the years, probably more often than not by the legislatures that preceded us. So they are generally doing those things that we have asked them to do. Feel like that we'd have a better organization if they were freed of some of these issues, which is one of the reasons that we brought the bill forward. As you're aware, there were two or three other bills that could have kind of addressed somewhat the same agenda. Having said this, I do think that, from where you all have discussed, there are some issues here, especially in relationship to the permitting process, which gets to be a real obstacle, whether it's the Division of State Lands or some other agency, as far as economic growth and advancement in our state. It seems to me that, given these things, that this is a topic that needs more discussion. The chair's intention is to suggest to leadership, as leadership appoints committees to work during the interim, that instead of you know, kind of going on a month-to-month ad hoc type of way that most of the interim committees that I've worked with, that we establish a, you know, the interim committees as maybe more work group oriented, and that this whole general area and general concept be part of then the agenda for an interim committee to deal with this issue and bring it back to the next session of the legislature with some committee recommendations for it. So unless there are strong objections to, and it doesn't sound like there would be, but strong objections to that point, that's the route that we'd like to go. Okay. Hearing none, then we will close the... just for the record, we have some testimony uninvited, but we'll still include it in the record from Scott Duckett, City of Eugene Public Works Department, and the testimony is in opposition to House Bill 2364. And you all will have a copy of that that you can subsequently put in your file. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2364. And if I get my committee administrator back here with what we need to be doing, we're going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2459, which requires hatchery fish bred from wild stock to be considered wild fish and allowed to spawn. And we have some proposed amendments, I think, to that bill that will take the fiscal out. But before we do that, well, we've already moved to reconsider, so we're back in to that point. So would you give us the amendments and the reason for the amendments?
The amendments to the bill, again, eliminate the last sentence that restricts all hatchery fish feed from wild stock. You have it in your file. It's 2459-1s.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
And what's the purpose of the amendment? Excuse me.
Okay. Go ahead.
What's the purpose of the amendment?
Generally, the major portion of the problem with the bill as far as fiscal is concerned, that would require all of the hatchery stock to become wild stock. They'd have to close down all their hatcheries with trout and anything else that are done for just catch and release or other programs and begin to get all brood stock for each individual stream. Obviously a massive process and massive costs which were added to the bill, but by taking that out, then it just relates to the salmon stock issue.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and this is consistent with the intent of the bill, was just to establish a policy and statute, and now that's all that it does.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move the dash ones to House Bill 2459.
Representative Krupp moves the dash ones to House Bill 2459. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2459 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Krupp moves House Bill 2459 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair.
Discussions.
Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
Yeah, I unfortunately was excused during the vote on this last time, but I will be a no vote on this bill. I've spent quite a bit of time on this issue, and I believe that this undermines the work of the Native Fish Conservation Policy Work Group, which spent many, many, many months grappling with this issue and came out with a policy that I felt that was well thought out and agreed on by all sides of the issue and most sides of the issue. So I will be a no vote on this bill.
Thank you, Representative. there other discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the roll, please.
President Floyd.
Aye.
President Cruz.
Aye.
President Shoffler.
No.
President Tomei.
No.
President Dingfeller.
No.
President Krupp.
Aye.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. Having received the majority, House Bill 2459 moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation. And would Representative Cruz like to carry this bill?
You know, Ms. Chair, I actually would.
So, thank you, Representative Cruz.
I should carry it.
Yes, you may.
So soon?
It will reopen the work.
I figured we're going to get time.
Reopen the work session on House Bill 2515. And what do we need to do on this, Mr. Best?
Generally, House Bill 2515 was heard before, and I think I read it once, but I'll do it again. Directs Oregon Water Resource Enhancement Board to provide funding for watershed improvement operating funds for position in soil and water conservation districts. Specify the persons employed in positions funded by board perform functions related to restoration and protection of native salmonid populations, watersheds, fish, wildlife habitats, and water quality. It has a fiscal statement, but it has not been priorly recommended to Ways and Means. It doesn't have a fiscal.
It wasn't prior?
It was not prior. So we would have to we'd have to recommend it.
Okay, yeah. Mr. Chair, clearly this needs to go to Ways and Means. I think this one slipped through the cracks somehow.
It was one of the early bills.
Yeah, and also I happen to know, Mr. Chair, that the chair of that subcommittee would like to have this bill as he's making his funding decisions.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move that House Bill 2515, I would move House Bill 2515 to the floor with subsequent referral to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2515 to the floor with subsequent referral to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chair. I feel like the committee naysayer today. During the hearing, we heard that there is a need for technical assistance, which I am very sympathetic with. And as I stated during the public hearing, I served on the Healthy Streams Partnership for several years with our actual committee staff here, Pete Test, and many other folks in this room. And we heard that technical assistance is a need, and we spent quite a bit of time surveying, talking to landowners, SWCDs, watershed councils, other organizations. I absolutely support the intent of the bill, which is to provide technical assistance. I do have an issue with how that technical assistance is funded, and so I will be a no vote on this bill. And that's because of the funding coming out of OWEB and concern about what programs would not receive funding since the pie is not actually growing. So we'd be basically robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Representative Shoffler.
Briefly, sir, thank you. I would love to give soil and water conservation districts more money for technical support, and someday I hope we can. And, you know, I think maybe we do have to look at how all this money is spent and see if we are getting the bang for our buck that we want. But at this time, I can't support this either. Thank you, though.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just say the funding decision is not ours to make. The policy decision is ours to make, and I think this is the appropriate policy. And we will let the debate continue down in the Ways and Means Sub, where it would be appropriate for it to continue at this point.
Representative Cruz.
Yes.
Of Representative Cruz. Didn't I hear something about policy versus funding from one of the other representatives just a bill or two ago?
No, it's something like that.
So. Okay.
For the record, I'll say that I don't think it's good policy to fund it from
the. Oh, okay, if you want to say that.
No. So, for the record, there you go.
All right.
No, Mr. Chair, I'm in favor of the policy. I think that the funding from that OWEB receives at the direction of the people of the state of Oregon for salmon recovery and stream restoration is an appropriate source, I believe, to help soil and water conservation districts help landowners comply with that. And I think it, again, goes back to the ideological viewpoint that we have here, that if something the law mandates has a public benefit, then the public should be willing to pay for part of that cost and do not place the entire cost of that mandate upon the landowners that have to comply with. I think that's a fair trade. I think it's a fair policy direction. I'm going to vote yes.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make one more point. It's the federal match program that is brand new, where the Fed is going to pay 50% of the cost of these employees, has specific conditions to meet that requirement, and this bill addresses those specific conditions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Question of Representative Dingfelder.
Yes.
Representative Dingfelder, do I take it then that you are parting ways with your former colleague, John McDonald?
No, he understands my concerns on this bill, and I just would like to respond to two points that were brought up. One is that the Soil and Water Conservation Districts already received $2.4 million from OWEB to help implement the Oregon Plan, and two, most of the money that OWEB does spend goes directly to projects on the ground to help landowners, and that's millions and millions of dollars. I'm saying that I was heavily involved as a Soil and Water Conservation District employee, and I wouldn't have been able to work for the district if it wasn't for the money that was received through OWEB, because that funded my position for technical assistance. So I'm sympathetic with the cause, however, concerned, like I said, with the source of funding. But John and I will still remain friends.
I'm sure that's true.
We don't have time here
to rebut.
No, Mr. Chair, he called me this morning. It wasn't necessary to come.
So. He said friendships aren't necessarily that deep. But no, I'm sure.
Wouldn't be the first time we disagreed with that.
Now, for the record, the chair sees one of the really major needs as we continue to address this whole issue of recovery in our state through the Oregon Plan, is the need for technical assistance. That is a major need, and without that need being filled, we run the risk that our dollars are not well spent. And even though OWEB has a dedicated source of money, and even though they're able to leverage other money with that, it doesn't do us any good if our dollars are not being spent in the right place. I mean, it's not the dollars that are being spent, it's whether or not they are fulfilling the basic objective of OWEB, and that is recovery, restoration and recovery. With that, I think this issue of addressing that is a good policy issue as far as this committee is concerned, and we will benefit from Ways and Means having a discussion about how and where these dollars come from, what we use them for. So if there's no further discussion, we call the roll, please.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Stoffler.
No.
Representative Tomei.
No.
Representative Dingfelder.
No.
Representative Krupp.
Aye.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. House Bill, what was that, 2515?
Right.
25. Yeah, House Bill 2515 moves to the, it declared passed, moves to the Committee on Ways and Means for their consideration. I think at this point, have we completed our agenda?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Test, and
And on time, I might add.
Yeah.
Very
pretty
well managed.
On time. That's something short of a miracle.
especially with this group.
But especially with this group. Actually, probably compliments of the wise and able work of the committee administrator in knowing just how to manage us in such a way as to get the maximum utilization of time and effort. With that, we are
adjourned. Good stuff there.
Yes. And this is a little bit of breach of protocol, but we have a guest who has driven down this morning to tell us some things, and I would be remiss if he didn't have a chance to talk to our committee for a minute. So you understand that we're off the record, but it's kind of like because I officially closed the hearing. But even though we're off the record, my assumption is that you can still hear and remember. So please, if you would.
May it please the chairman and members of the committee, I'm William F. Holscher. I'm an attorney at law, Oregon State Bar number 73140. And I want to address you very, very quickly because I know you have to go back in session. I appreciate Chairman's allowing me this opportunity because I couldn't get away from Portland in a timely manner. And I'd be happy to supply something in writing if there are any questions. As a matter of background, I was hired by Lee Johnson as the state's first labor lawyer, a special assistant to the Attorney General, and I held that position through Johnson's administration, Brown's, Redden's, and Frohnmeyer's until I retired in December 31st, 1984. And during that period of time, pertinent to this matter, which is, in my understanding, the amendments to House Bill 2431, I, one, helped draft the Attorney General's model rules for contested cases way back in 1972. And during the 11 years that I was with the Department of Justice, I had hundreds of administrative hearings of one sort and another. I was also the assigned counsel to the Public Employees Retirement System and to the Employment Relations Board, and there were hearings every day in those agencies. The point I want to make for you, or to you, is simply that the entire contested case hearing proceedings in the Attorney General's model rules all are in compliance with ORS Chapter 183, the Administrative Procedures Act. And the basis of that act is that citizens with or without attorney burden or help may have their petitions, their applications, their permits, and so forth decided in a timely manner by an impartial hearings officer, reviewed by the agency, a final order issued, and the opportunity to go either to the Circuit Court of Marion County or the Circuit Court of the county in which the petitioner resides, or to the Court of Appeals, depending upon the case. And there's nothing in ORS Chapter 183 to the contrary to that. And the Attorney General's model rules similarly attempt to see all these matters resolved quickly and given a final review all the way up through the Court of Appeals if the petitioner is so mindful. So in terms of the bill that's before you, I know there are a number of provisions that are important, and I won't speak to them other than for Section 11 of ORS 196.825, and in that section the provision is made that if the director does not make a final decision of the issuance of a permit within 90 days after the date the application is complete, and no extension of time has been allowed pursuant to subsection 7B of the section,
or if a final decision on a contested case is not rendered within 120 days from the date of the contested case hearing, then the individual may go to the circuit court and apply for a writ of mandamus. And that, by the way, is wholly in keeping with ORS 183.490, agency may be compelled to act, which states, quote, the court may, upon petition as described in ORS 183.484, compel an agency to act where it has unlawfully refused to act or make a decision or unreasonably delayed taking action or making a decision, unquote. I understand in the case of my friend Mr. Mel Stewart that he applied for a permit relative to land that he wished to develop for housing purposes. He was denied that permit sort of informally, and no decision or order was ever issued. And he asked for a hearing on July of 1999, and he still has not received a hearing as of this date. And that is not the spirit or the law in ORS Chapter 183. And so I think the 120-day rule is very important. And I would tell you only, based on my practice of law since I left the Department of Justice, this bill costs nothing. There is a provision of using the pilot project for the hearings officers, and I don't consider that a cost because somebody's going to have to conduct the hearing, whether it's out of that panel or somebody from the agency. And I think this bill will save money for the public, for the state, and the other agencies of the cities and counties. The cities, by the way, have the same statute. They have to have a decision within 120 days after an application is made. And I think it'll save money because it will speed up both the administrative hearings and the court appeals. And these administrative hearings cost the agencies, whether they're represented by the Department of Justice or not. And the delay in these matters creates more lawsuits. The last thing is, and because I come from the Portland, Tigard area, I believe this bill, getting administrative hearings decided in a timely fashion and set for appeal to the courts, will encourage the development of land, encourage new industries to come into Oregon, and develop both land and the small business and the employment that goes therewith. And I thank you very kindly for this opportunity.
Thank you very much for appearing before us. Thank you. And we are adjourned.